Everybody, I'm Betty Cohn Fredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Betty Show. And I was just sitting in my office on the Upper West Side here in New York City, and I was thinking that it's actually over 10 years that I have been hosting the Ask Betty Show, and I will never forget the day when I met Dr. Gary Null for the very first time at the Stodio on Broadway in New York City. And we were really talking about the kind of show that would really be able to educate and empower people. And of course, I had wanted originally to do my usual call-in counseling radio talk show that I had done on a number of different mainstream networks over the years. And unfortunately, I have to say that this has not become the call-in counseling talk show that Gary Null and I had originally talked about. And yet, I am still encouraging all of you, and I understand it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon in New York City, that it is a time when probably most of you are at work. And yet, you know, we all go through so many ups and downs in our life. And sometimes all we really need to do is pick up the phone and just talk about how it is that we're feeling, whether or not we're feeling scared or whether or not we're feeling lonely or depressed, because it's always about trying to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can the issues that continue to get in the way of our lives. And there is nobody that I've ever known, I'm sure nobody that has ever existed in this world, that doesn't go through significant ups and downs. And yet the very, very, very best thing that we can all do is, if we're sad or mad or angry or depressed, is to be able to reach out and talk to someone, and reach out particularly on the Ask Betty Show and talk to me. So I want to give you the call-in number again. It is 888-874-4888. And for those of you who actually may be tuning in for the very, very first time, and you're wondering, who is Betty Cohn Fredos? Well, I am a psychotherapist. I'm also a sex therapist. And I am the author of the groundbreaking book on relationships. It's a book that I certainly wish that I had when I was starting my own dating and relationship life many, many years ago. The book is For Better, For Worse, Forever: Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And this book is significant. It is a significant book, not because I wrote it, but because what we are seeing in our society is we are seeing an increase in domestic violence. We are seeing an increase in the divorce rate. And what this book does, it teaches us all how to accurately assess. And I know that assess and assessment, these are not sexy or romantic words, but they're very important words. And the book, based on my research with 450 people in the Providence, Connecticut, and Boston area, it teaches us exactly how to assess who is right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. And given the domestic violence statistics, which are continuing to increase, despite all of the talk about domestic violence, I mean, clearly something is amiss. So again, if you are starting a brand new relationship with somebody, the very best thing that you can actually say to yourself is that this person who I think I like, who I think I'm attracted to, who I think I can trust, is somebody who appears to be who he or she seems to be. And what my research found, and I was very upset about the research findings, because in my personal life, I'm probably one of the most impatient people that you would ever want to meet. The research found is that it takes about a year to really find out who somebody is and isn't. And this process, unfortunately, can really not be fast forwarded. Now, obviously, if you are in an early stage of a relationship and you can experience and you can see the toxicity that is going on, you're not going to stay in for a year. But again, and as I say this to my patients all the time, we have to be so careful who we actually let into our lives. And these days, since it seems as if the majority of people are on online dating sites, I mean, the best thing we can do is, if we are trying to connect with somebody after a couple of online talks and chats, you want to get to meet the person in person and start the process, if both of you are interested in finding out who is this person. You need to start the assessment process. You know, I was thinking about a patient that I treated a couple of years ago, and she arrived one day and she was telling me that she was madly in love with this really terrific man. And of course, I asked her a lot of questions about him. And as it turned out, they were sexting and texting and chatting for almost a year, but they had never, ever met in person. So this was an amazing fantasy, really, for both of them. So I said to her, look, you both live pretty close together. I think it's time, after a year, that you're going to sit down, you're going to meet face to face and see what happens. So that was exactly what did occur. They met, and guess what happened? Well, the reality was that after this face-to-face real-life meeting, they never saw each other again. So again, knowing the truth, finding out the reality of who a person is or is not, you may not, you know, come away with the hope for results that you would be hoping for, but yet you are going to, once and for all, you are going to know the truth about who this person is and who this person is not. So, what is this show really all about? The show is about empowerment. We talk about all of the things that we can actually do, not just think about, not just dream about, not just talk about, to improve the quality of our lives and our relationships. So naturally, we talk about mental health issues. And by the way, October is Mental Health Awareness Month. And of course, October is also Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And we're going to be talking a lot during this show about mental health issues and domestic violence. We also talk about sexuality. I'm a sex therapist as well, and relationships, and mostly how and what we need to do to maximize our physical and emotional well-being despite the stressors of life. And again, I have a mantra that I try to live by myself. And that mantra is, we need to be willing, we need to be honest with ourselves to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we possibly can. We cannot change history. We cannot change something that happened 30 seconds ago. So try to resolve as best as we can the things that get in the way of our really being able to live a joyful and happy life. And what I really hope that I have convinced you over the years is that we do not need to navigate this journey on our own. So that if you are struggling, the very best thing that you can do is, if you're lucky, to reach out to family and friends, and if need be, professionals. And in doing so, in this outreach, it really makes our life journey easier and less isolated and alienated and lonely. But again, as I'm mentioning, the month of October is Mental Health Awareness Month. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at some of the statistics, and one really, really hopes that with all the talk and all the chat about my mental health, that we're going to see a decrease in what is going on in terms of people's struggles. So what are some of these statistics? Well, worldwide, there are about 350 million people worldwide who are suffering from depression. In the United States, about 17 million adults in the United States suffer from depression, which translates into about 7.1% of all adults, females 8.7%, and females experience depression at roughly 2 times the rate of men. But I think that that may not really be an accurate statistic. I think that women, typically, we have sought help more frequently than men. I think that we have been willing more frequently than men to also talk about our feelings of depression and sadness. So I really question whether or not women are actually experiencing depression at 2 times the rate for men. And, you know, the thing is that if we are willing early on to take the necessary steps, which of course means reaching out and asking for help if you're finding that the depression and the anxiety and other psychiatric problems are simply not going away, even though you're eating well and you're sleeping and you're exercising. You know, this is where, you know, the buck really has to stop with you, and you have to ask yourself the question, what am I going to do? And I understand that accessing mental health treatment, particularly in this country, is not easy at all. I know that, in fact, yesterday I was with a couple, and the man was exhibiting psychotic symptoms during the session in my office. And what was very, very, very clear is that he was going to need to see an MD psychiatrist, and that he was going to have to be prescribed some antipsychotic medication. So after the session, now yesterday was Sunday, and yes, I do see people during the weekend on occasion, we were trying, he and his wife and I, to find a psychiatrist here in New York City who would be able to see him ideally today or this week. And I received an email from this man's wife, and she was saying that they absolutely were having no luck at all. And for this particular couple, the money was not the issue. They were calling and calling various different psychiatrists in the hospitals and psychiatrists who were in private practice, and they were told that these people were not taking new patients. So access is sometimes very, very, very difficult. And not only is access challenging, really finding the right person for you, because all therapists and all doctors and all dentists and our lawyers are not necessarily going to be your cup of tea. And especially if you are going to be in a therapeutic relationship, you really and truly need to feel that there is some kind of positive connection that you are going to be able to develop with your particular therapist. And I want to just really cite you some of the most recent statistics, and these are depression rate statistics. And this is a Gallup poll study. And here we have women and young adults have experienced the greatest increases, and Black and Hispanic adults rising at about twice the rate of white adults. So what we're seeing is that the percentage of United States adults who report having been diagnosed with depression at some point in their lifetime has reached 29%. That's a very, very high percentage, nearly 10 percentage points higher than in 2015. And the percentage of Americans who have currently have or are being treated for depression has also increased to 17.8%, which is also up about 7 points over the same period. And both rates, by the way, are the highest recorded by the Gallup poll since it began measuring depression using the current form of data collection in 2015. And the most recent results, and these results were obtained in February 2023, are based on 5,100, almost 5,200 United States adults surveyed by the Gallup poll, and a probability-based panel of about 100,000 adults across all 50 states. And the respondents were asked, they were asked this question: has a doctor or nurse ever told you that you have depression? And do you currently have, or are you currently being treated for depression? So both metrics are part of the ongoing Gallup National Health and Well-Being Index. So rates among, again, women, young adults, Black and Hispanic adults are rising the fastest. Over one-third of women, which is 36.7%, that's a really, really high percentage, now report having been diagnosed with depression at some point in their lifetime, compared, and this is interesting, with 20.4% of men, and the rate has risen at nearly twice the rate of men since 2017. And those aged 18 to 29, a little over 34%, and 30 to 44, almost 35%, has significantly greater depression diagnosis rates in their lifetime than those older than 44. A few more statistics here. Women, and I don't want to depress you, but we have to look at the reality of what's going on, and then, of course, more importantly, what to do. So women, almost 24%, and adults aged 18 to 29 have the highest rates of current depression or treatment for depression. And lifetime depression rates are also climbing fast among Black and Hispanic adults and have now surpassed those of white respondents. Okay, so there is a real mental health crisis that is going on in this country. And, years ago, I mean, who would have thought that we are seeing the kinds of statistics, depression statistics, suicidal statistics that we're seeing now with teens? And I want to cite some mental health statistics from the Mayo Clinic about what is going on with teenagers in this country. So teen depression is a serious mental health problem that causes a persistent feeling of sadness and loss of interest in activities. It affects how your teenager thinks, feels, and behaves, and it can cause emotional, functional, and physical problems. And although depression can occur at any time in life, symptoms may be different between teens and adults, and issues such as peer pressure, academic expectation, changing bodies, hormones can bring a lot of ups and downs for teens, but for some teens, the lows are more than just temporary feelings. They are symptoms of clinical depression. And we have to really find a way to get this message across to teens. And it's not a weakness or something that can be just overcome with necessarily just willpower. It can have serious consequences and requires at times long-term treatment. And for most teens, depression symptoms ease with treatment, such as with psychological counseling. And sometimes there is a need for medication. So if you are a parent of a teen, I want, or a teacher, I want you to be alert for these kinds of emotional changes, such as feelings of sadness, which can include crying spells for no apparent reason, and feelings of sadness that don't seem to really lift, frustration or feelings of anger, even over small matters. Again, we all get angry, but it is the persistence of these emotions that are really getting in the way of our life and our activities and our relationships that we really must not ignore. Feelings of hopelessness or emptiness, irritability or annoyed mood, loss of interest or pleasure in usual activities, loss of interest in or conflict with family and friends. Again, all of these will happen to all of us from time to time, but again, it is the persistence that we need to be concerned about. Low self-esteem, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, fixation on past failures or exaggerated self-blame or self-criticism. Extreme sensitivity to rejection or failure and the need for excessive reassurance. Again, all of these feelings are normal feelings that we all experience from time to time. But again, it is the persistence when these feelings go on and on and on and don't lift. That is when we are in trouble. And that is the time when it's really important that people reach out and get some help. There was an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, and looking at what kids are going through, and the headline was "A Strong Case for School Phone Bans." I was doing some consulting at East Hampton High School last year, and hopefully, I'm going to be going back again this year. And one of the things that was really great is that the teachers did not allow the kids to be on their phones during the classes. The phones had to be turned off. So at least in that way, at least for short periods of time, the kids were in the moment. They were not looking at the likes and the chats and the Facebook and trying to integrate all of this with also trying to learn about reading and math and science and health issues. And I think that we've really become, it's so strange. I was walking down Broadway this morning, just and almost bumping into people who were on their phones. And a couple of weeks ago, I was on the subway, and I think almost every single person, I was on my way to the US Open tennis tournament, and almost every single person that was on the subway was on their phone. And in the old days, we used to either sit or we would talk to the person, who was sitting next to us. And I think that all of this has really caused more and more of a disconnect. And the more that we are disconnected from one another, we are going to be at a much, much, much higher risk for depression and other mental health, kinds of issues. And Over the weekend, I think I had mentioned to you multiple times that I am the advice columnist for Dan's papers in the Hamptons and in Palm Beach. And I think that it's one thing to talk about all of these problems. And it's another thing to sit down and to strategize about what can we actually do. And so over the weekend, I wrote an article, and it's going to be in Dan's papers in a couple of weeks. And the headline, the title is "The Key to Successful Mental Health Care." And in my opinion, yes, we need to talk about it, and we need to talk about medication and therapy and the difficulty of access. But in my experience, and I have been a practicing psychotherapist now for over 35 years, and every single time that I say that, I can hardly believe how quickly the last 35 years have really gone by. And I have been so privileged, so privileged to be able to treat thousands and thousands of children and adolescents and men and women from every walk of life with every conceivable kind of problem. And when I think about that, I mean, I grew up in Winnipeg, Canada, in an Orthodox Jewish family where I would never, had I not gone into the profession that I have been in for all these years, that I would never have been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to meet all of these people with all of these different kinds of issues. And even more importantly, you know, what an honor. What an opportunity it has been for me to be able to help thousands and thousands of people with a variety of different kinds of mental health issues and sexual problems and relationship issues as well. But what I have found over the years, and it really goes back to my days when I was a school social worker in Montreal, and then I became one of the directors of the Greater Montreal School Social Services Program. And what that taught me is that the key to successful mental health care for all of us, is early identification and intervention. And what that means is that the earlier our problems can be identified, and the earlier that we are able to access good mental health care, it is going to change the trajectory of our lives and also of our society. So President Biden, he actually proclaimed May 2023 is National Mental Health Awareness Month, but also October is National Mental Health Awareness Month as well. And so this month honors the courage of tens of billions of Americans living with a variety of mental health conditions and joining with the hundreds of millions of people around the world who actually recognize World Mental Health Day. And I just found this out yesterday that World Mental Health Day happens to be on October the 10th of every single year. And the theme for 2020, developed by the World Foundation of Mental Health, and I love this, is a game-changing breakthrough that mental health, when you think about it, is a universal right. Mental health is a universal right. And what I've found is that, yes, celebrating and acknowledging these days is really important. It is an important first step in encouraging discussions and changing narratives about mental health issues. Yes, it's important to talk about it. It's important to celebrate. However, However, we've got to get real about this, and that is that there is so much more that can be done and should be done during the rest of the year to help normalize the discussions about mental health and mental health treatment. And what I'm saying is that people wait way, way, way too long. And part of that is the lack of access. Part of that is the cost of therapy. Because the reality is, again, that access to care and treatment for mental health issues remains, it's out of reach for most people in the United States. And our people who are listening to the show, they're probably thinking, well, what does Beatty do? What does Beatty do to actually help people access and costs? And I want you to know that I have always, always, when I began, and even these years, I've always had a sliding scale. I want to work with people so that they are going to be able to access the best possible mental health care and not be overwhelmed and not get in debt because of the fees. And in New York City, the fees are absolutely astronomical. I mean, there are doctors that charge over $1,000 for a psychiatric evaluation. And again, if you are someone who is looking to find a therapist, and I know it's scary, and maybe your insurance covers part of it, or maybe you don't have insurance at all, but give yourself permission to ask your therapist whether or not he or she would be willing to work with you around the fee. And frankly, you know, if you were bold enough, if you had the courage to raise this issue, you know, over and above all the other problems that you may be facing, and if you have a therapist who says no, you are going to be fortunate then to not be working with someone where the bottom line is money. And even if it was a 10% decrease in the fee or some kind of payment plan, I believe that those of us in the mental health field, if we really care about our patients, if we really care about the kind of work that we are doing, that we should all be willing to a greater or lesser degree to be willing to negotiate fees. Because what we're seeing is that more than one-fifth of the adults in the United States, 21%, 52.9 million, were diagnosed with a mental health illness in 2020. So from 2002 to 2019, the number of adults aged 18 or older with mental illness increased. And look at this increase. It increased from 39.8 million to 51.5 million. And that is nearly a 30% increase. And the pandemic further exacerbated, we know that, mental health problems for all ages, among and including adults ages 18 and older. And in addition, the figures paint a highly disturbing piece of the growing youth mental health crisis. And listen to these figures. From 2009 to 2019, the share of high school students who reported experiencing persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness increased 41%. From 2010 to 2020, suicide rates increased by 62% among adolescents ages 12 to 17. You think about kids who are 12, who are just starting puberty. They're just beginning their lives in so many ways, where the suicide death rates increased by 62%. In early 2021, emergency department visits for suicide attempts were 51% higher for adolescent girls and 4% higher for adolescent boys than in early 2019. So what is going on? In October 2021, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the Children's Hospital Association declared child and adolescent mental health a national emergency. And we've not yet been able to comprehend the magnitude of the problem and the suffering of millions of people, young and old. And again, one of the basic issues that we have not grappled with is how expensive. Here again, the fees it is for people to pay for ongoing counseling. So again, I want to give you permission that if you are thinking about and if you are reaching out to a therapist, to please, please ask about negotiating fees, a sliding scale. And if the person is so adamant that they are not willing to give you some reduction, even a small reduction, this is not somebody who you would probably want to be working with. And if you're lucky enough, if you're one of the people in this country who is really lucky enough to have insurance, they have a cap. I remember years and years ago, it was 20 visits. It was 20 visits a year. And then the therapist, we needed to write letters and we needed to give all kinds of information as to why the person needed more than 20 visits per year, which for many, many, many people, it was absolutely insufficient. So yes, we have some issues. We have some real issues here in this country. We certainly do. But the thing that I want to really talk about is the role of the school. We are with children, probably some of the time more often we are spending time with kids and sometimes even the parents. And we are able to see early on children that are having issues. They're having behavioral issues. They're acting out, or they're not socializing, or they seem depressed, or they are not doing well in their studies. And this is where the school, beginning at the kindergarten level, beginning at the first grade level, where we are able to identify really early on kids that are potentially at risk. And this was something that when I was one of the directors of the Montreal School Social Services program, that was one of the absolute best things that happened is that we had the opportunity very, very close up and very, very early on to be able to see the kids that were struggling. And we were able to routinely, we educated the teachers so they knew when there was a problem. And we were able to refer the children to school social workers and to psychologists and if need be, psychiatrists, so that in those days, certainly in the Montreal school system, truly that no child was really left behind. It was a wonderful way. It was an absolute wonderful way to be able to identify early on kids that were at risk. And, some people will say, well, do you want to turn your schools into psychiatric clinics? Well, obviously, we don't. We certainly don't. But the thing is that the schools, they have an important role in normalizing the talk, so that it is not something to be embarrassed about. It is not something to be afraid about. To be able to normalize the talk about mental health and substance abuse, and in that way, yes, I think that a lot of money, a lot more money, should be given to the schools to be able to hire more mental health people. One of the things that I'm really hoping to do this year at East Hampton High School, and I had discussed this with the superintendent and with the principal of the school, is to have Ask Beattie boxes throughout the school, where students would be able to anonymously ask me. And of course, I think this should be done in all the schools around the country. They would be able to anonymously ask a therapist questions about mental health issues, about relationships, about sexuality, and about substance abuse. And not only would they be encouraged to ask the questions, but then there should be regular schedules that could be set up where the students' questions would be answered either in the classroom or at a student assembly. Because the reality is, when we think about this, is that we all go through so many ups and downs in our life, regardless of our age, our socioeconomic background, our ethnicity, our race, or our sexual orientation. And the reality in itself is something. You see, that's what needs to be routinely communicated to our young people so that they do not feel alone and they do not feel isolated and they don't feel that there's something wrong with them. They need to understand, and we as adults can help them understand the importance of acknowledging, addressing, and resolving, as best as we can, the difficulties that are getting in the way of their lives and relationships. And they need to understand, of course, whether you're young or whether or not you're old, that it is our avoidance, it is our denial. It is our blame, it is our self-blame and our defensiveness that only keeps us in a downward spiral. And they also need to know and feel that people do care, that we don't need, again, I say this over and over and over again, that we do not need to navigate life's challenges on our own, and that the very, very best thing that we can do when life becomes too difficult, whether or not we are young or old, is to reach out and ask for help. And our schools can and need to be much more proactive in their role as educators, and do a better job in identifying, intervening, and also, of course, defraying costs for the mental health crisis that we are really all in. Because we talk about this all the time, our precious children are our future. We say that we love them. And the schools and those programs can be one of the ways that we can show them that we really, really do mean what we say. It's not what you say, it's what we do. And if we're all in this together, I mean, we could really, really help early on to avoid so many of the crises that we are seeing with our young people. And this is something that I have been committed to for really all of my career. And I saw what it was like being a school social worker. And I started off as a school social worker in the inner city schools in Greater Montreal. And it was an amazing program because we all worked together. We were a team, the teachers and the psychologists and all of the resource people, including the principals and the vice principal. We were committed. We were committed not only to academic achievement, which obviously is important, but if the kids are struggling, they are not going to be able to concentrate. They are not going to be able to achieve. If they're dealing with depression, if they're dealing with domestic violence in their homes, if they're dealing with a variety of different kinds of problems and mental health issues. So what I'm hoping actually to do, and I was thinking about, you know, as the advice columnist for, you know, Dan's papers in the Hamptons and in Palm Beach, I mean, East Hampton High School, I feel, is really a model of mental health awareness, and there's identification and there's intervention. But there are other schools and other school boards, and it was very interesting, and I'm not going to name the school or the school board at this point. But last week, I decided that I wanted to reach out to one of the other schools, one of the other principals of a high school in the Hamptons. And I sent her a lovely email and I introduced myself and I had some ideas about wanting to talk with her and getting together. And I have yet to hear back. So again, you know, we have an opportunity here to really, really make a difference. I know that I am just so concerned about what is going on with the depression and the suicidal ideation and suicide rates with our young people. And talking about it is clearly not enough. Just like talking about domestic violence, and again, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, that too is not enough. And in fact, at looking at the domestic violence statistics in this country, with all of the domestic violence awareness programs, what we are seeing is a steady increase in domestic violence. And 31% of all women, and these are current statistics, my friends, will experience domestic violence. And for Black women, that number goes up to 40%. So again, the question is what to do? And for so many years, I have been committed to relationship education. I am so clear after all these years of being a practicing psychotherapist and sex therapist, what the problems are, why we are engaging in these toxic, violent relationships, whether or not they are abusive emotionally, physically, sexually, financially. And what's much more important, I mean, we're talking about the problems over and over and over again. And yet, I'm very clear about what we need to do to really teach our young people about what it means to be in a healthy relationship. And for those of you who've been, you know, listening to the Ask Beattie show for all these years, you've heard me over and over and over again talk about the three things that we need to do to never make a mistake in love again. So I'm going to repeat it again since we're talking about Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The first thing, we need, each of us, we need to be in a good place ourselves emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically. So what that means is that we need to be willing to deal with our own issues. And as I used to tell my daughter Jordana when she was a little girl, that the relationship needs to be the icing on the cake. We need to be the cake. We need to be able to function on our own. And yes, it's wonderful to have a healthy relationship, and it's wonderful to be in love. But we need to be okay so that we are able to have the clarity in being able to make good decisions about who we let into our lives. So that's number one. And then number two, again, over and over again, beginning ideally in our family, and if not in our family, in our schools, we need to have clarity about what ingredients go into a healthy relationship. And it is not too early in kindergarten or in first grade to be teaching our children, whether or not we're talking about healthy relationship with friends, whether we're talking about healthy relationships with family. The kids need to learn early on what it means to be in a good relationship, what it means to be in a bad relationship, what a toxic relationship is all about, so that we have clarity about who we are going to let into our lives and who we are going to spend time on and spend time with. And the third thing, and again, it's not about selling books. My book is clear when it comes to helping people to assess how to go about assessing who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. You know, before I did the book, you know, the very spontaneous person I think that I used to be, and probably not so much now, is that I would meet somebody and I would say something like this: "Oh, I met this really nice person. I met this really smart person. I met a person who is trustworthy." I would never, ever, ever make that kind of a statement today. And people say, "Well, what would you say? What would you say?" The very best thing that I could say, and the very, very best thing that you could say, is that I've met somebody who appears to be nice. I've met somebody who appears to be honest. I've met somebody who appears to be truthful and respectful. And again, I was very upset with my research results, which really found that it does take about a year to find out who somebody is and is not. And had there been a way to be able to fast forward the process, I think I would have figured it out a long time ago. And one of the best times to find out who this person really is when there are problems, when there is conflict, because there are problems and conflict in the best of relationships. And it is at that point you are going to see how respectful that person is. You are going to find out about a person's communication and problem-solving skills. You are going to find out whether that person is capable of emotional intimacy, whether the person has the maturity to be able to say to you, "I am so sorry that I said this," or "I am so sorry that I behaved this way, and I am so sorry that I hurt you." And these are the things that are going to keep us safe in our lives and in our relationships. Because again, I'm looking in front of me at some of the domestic violence statistics. Four women are killed every single day in the United States as a result of domestic violence. Every year, 1.2 million women are forcibly raped by their current or former male partner. I'm looking at divorce rates. The divorce rate for third marriages, the divorce rate for third marriages is 73%. 48% divorce rate for first marriages, 67% of second marriages fail. 30% of college co-eds are talking about being in a domestic violent relationship. So again, there are so many things. There are so many positive things that we can do to educate and empower people. And I'm absolutely, absolutely committed to trying to get more and more and more schools to put more resources, financial resources and personnel resources into early identification and early intervention. And in doing so, we can really create a much better society, and we can really have a positive impact when it comes to mental health in this country. So it's 3:56, everybody, in beautiful New York City today. And I hope that this was not a depressing show. I mean, we're looking at the facts. We need to be honest about what's going on and what's not going on in this country. But there are many, many things that we can actually do to change the trajectory of these problems. So I want to leave you with my two weekly messages, and I hope you're really going to take these messages in. The first, of course, is to do everything that you can possibly do to be living your life in ways that are in your best interest. That means to love yourself and to be very, very careful who we let into our lives. And secondly, of course, we can all and we should be doing a much, much, much better job in learning to respect and in learning to love the other. So I hope you are going to have a really good rest of the day. I think after a heavy-duty show like this, why not take a walk? Why not move around a little bit? Then you can kind of get back to what you were doing. I also really would love to get your feedback. You can reach me through my website, mybeattycohn.com website. Would love to hear your questions and your comments. And again, I hope you have a really good rest of the day and a good week. And we'll talk next week. So goodbye, everybody. Take good care. And thank you again, my terrific producers at the Progressive Radio Network. I really appreciate you in all kinds of ways. You make things very, very easy for me to do the show every week again. Thanks so much.